Greetings, you curiouser and curiouser hurly-burlyites. We've got a finance minister in the house today. These people tend to have rather busy schedules, so I'll get right to it. The Honourable Peter Bethlenfalvy, Minister of Finance for Ontario, is our guest today. He earned his Master's of Business Administration from McGill University, because he's from Montreal, and his Master's of Political Science from U of T. Prior to politics, he had a long and successful career in business and finance, holding senior roles at CST Consultants, DBRS, Manulife Financial, and TD Securities. First elected to the legislature in 2018, an election I try to forget, he likes to remember. In Premier Ford's first cabinet, he was appointed president of the Treasury Board and succeeded Rod Phillips in the finance portfolio on the last day of 2020. As you may have heard, he's been in the news lately, releasing the province's 2024 budget just 8 days ago, Building a Better Ontario. That's what we're going to be talking about today. Broadly, how does Minister Bethlenfalvy and the Ford government intend to deliver on that promise? We'll talk investments in housing and infrastructure, economic growth, clean energy and public services, and lots more. Minister Bethlenfalvy, I'm really grateful for you giving us an hour of our little humble pod today to talk about your plans. It's great to have you. Thanks for doing it.
Well, David, I'm a big fan of your the show, the podcast, and The Curse of Politics. You know, it's fascinating to listen to you guys talk, and with the history and experience you folks have, it's really great. Real service.
We are old. There's no doubt about that. We're old.
Yeah, yeah. No, great to be on.
Great to be on. So I knew you in a previous incarnation before you were involved in politics. How are you finding politics? You finding it enjoyable, fulfilling? What do you think?
You know, Bill Davis said his worst day of politics was better than his best day in the private sector. And I understand what he's talking about. You know, it is such a privilege and a fascinating role to be in politics. And what I would say is, you know, as someone who, you know, with my backstory and being the son of some refugees, my parents from Hungary and Slovakia during the World War, you know, I'm so grateful for this country to have the opportunity to kind of hopefully make Ontario and Canada a little better place is very humbling. And I would say this also that, you know, also, you know, while there's lots that you can bring from the private sector, the public sector and public service, whether you're on the political side or on the civil service side, is a very unique skill set. It you know, so you have to take attributes from both, and you can't just move seamlessly from one to the other.
Right. That's really interesting. I'm just going to follow up on that right away. What have you found about the Ontario public service that surprised you, given the assumptions you had from the outside?
Well, that's a very good question. I would say number one is how dedicated they are. I mean, I knew they were dedicated, but, you know, they operate under the Public Services Act. We are public servants. They are public servants. And to have a career that is dedicated to making the province a better place, I think it's a very noble profession. I also think the, you know, I grew up at TD Bank. That was my first job. And I found it was a large organization, and I was, and I'm a curious learning machine. So I found that you could have a diverse career at TD Bank by moving around into different departments. The same in public service. You can spend your whole career in one organization and never be bored and learn new things and be very productive at the same time. And thirdly, I would just say, you know, we are very fortunate to have the quality of people that get attracted to public service.
Mm. Cool. Excellent. So, but to go back, yes, government is one thing, but politics is another. You're a member of the legislature. You have all those responsibilities. You got to go out and campaign. You got to go out and glad hand the rubber chicken circuit. All that stuff. How do you find it? It's not for everybody.
I love it. I love it. I mean, I was up in Lawrence and Young this morning for one of those breakfast events. Hopped on the subway. By the way, the subways are full, which is really encouraging. Downtown to the Toronto Regional Board of Trade to give a speech. I'm meeting with credit rating agencies. I'm out in the riding tomorrow. I'm giving a speech at the Oakville Chamber of Commerce. You know, this is the diversity of experiences that you get in the job. You got to be a people person though, at the end of the day. You got to really be curious. So you have to be engaging. You got to be a bit of an extrovert. And boy, I learn the most when I talk to people. I'm in the Pink Palace right now, as it's called, at Queen's Park, looking at the legislature from my office. And, you know, it's great here, but being out there is where you really get a pulse of what the heck is going on in people's lives. And there's a lot going on that often people south of, I don't know, Bloor Street just wouldn't connect with.
Right. Have you calculated, just out of curiosity, how much time in your life you have spent correcting the spelling or pronunciation of your name?
I love that. I love this. I mean, I forced the whole Ontario media and beyond nationally to have to figure out how to pronounce Bethlen Folly. I mean, if I that best, I think what a legacy. And I know that's brought sweat to the upper lips of a lot of people. I'm very proud. I'm very proud because I'm very proud of my heritage, and I'm very proud. I opened my speech, my budget speech, dedicating it to my father, and I did that because I grew up. With on my mother's side, meeting three of my great grandparents, my grandparents, obviously my mother and her brother, and they all lived under one roof, and they had nothing but the shirt on their backs when they came. And by the way, there's no guarantee that they were getting out alive during World War II, and they found their way through us from Hungary, through Austria to Sweden to Canada, and I thought, what a great country this is. And my dad. That you could have that opportunity to raise a family, to feel safe, to have a good job. And my father had a different experience. He left when he was 19, a little bit older. He never saw his parents again. The Iron Curtain went up, and I thought, you know, and he came to this country, and all he wanted was an opportunity. He worked, he was industrious, he worked hard, he got into U of T engineering. Still to this day, he's got the thickest Hungarian accent. And he got a job, and he was able to raise a family and one of three kids. If that isn't if that doesn't give you the oxygen to serve, and I think that's one of the backstories for me, and makes this experience so fulfilling.
Yeah, that's a pretty good story. That's pretty remarkable, and it is the great story about the upward mobility of Canada.
The social mobility, the income equality, you know, we strive for social mobility. We strive for income equality. We have lots of challenges, a very turbulent world. But let me tell you this. I also do travel the world, and Canada is a beacon of stability. It's a beacon of hope, freedom, and for many people around the world. And I think we have, you know, I kid with my dad. He says, you know, you're the Ontario finance minister. You know, what's next? I say, Dad, as Ontario goes, Canada goes. And as Canada goes, the free world goes. I've got the best job.
You got an important job.
Yeah.
You do have a very important job. Okay, let's talk about your budget. Now, I don't know. You've been talking about it all day, so maybe you're talked out. But I know that you're jazzed about it. I know that you like your budget. So what do you like about it? Tell me what's in there that's got you excited.
Oh, I love that. You know, I think coming from the business side, one thing in the business side, you have to have a vision and a plan. And you got to be able to articulate that plan and put it in front of your board members, your shareholders, your stakeholders, your employees. And that's what we've done. And in my first budget, you know, we're still in COVID, so it was very much a COVID budget, but our election budget, and we ran on my budget in 2022, we put out a vision for the province, how we saw the province unfold, and we took it to the people, and we basically didn't make any changes to that budget, and it was a plan to build the infrastructure, the economy, support the workers that are doing that, and then to be able to come out with my fourth budget, David, that basically is a continuation of that plan. It's a vision, and it's really important. And, you and I were at the Mulroney funeral, which was just a remarkable funeral and a really special moment, a privilege to be there. And I was thinking about him in terms of, you know, I worked on the 1998 campaign. I got into politics in part because, I grew up in Quebec, as you mentioned, Saint-Lambert, on the south shore of Montreal, and having these strong patriotic feelings about Canada and federalism. And in 1976, I was kind of going, hey, Mom, Dad, look, there's a government that's getting elected. They want a majority. I was glued to the TV that wants out of Canada. Qu'est-ce qui se passe? And so in 1980, I worked on the No campaign and in Montreal and that one. And then this guy comes along, Brian Mulroney, and I said, okay, I'm in. I volunteered on his campaign. So you know, it was an honor and a real privilege to be at his funeral and pay my respects to him. But it also got me thinking, you know, I worked on the 88 campaign. I moved to Toronto in 85. I went up to the MP of the riding, Etobicoke Centre, and said, "Do you need a volunteer?" And he said, "Yes, that would be fantastic." And that was Michael Wilson. And so I was on his riding association, on his campaign team. And I've got to tell you, that vision for Canada was not easy, the free trade agreement. You know, and really it brought out the passions. But Mulroney had not only the vision and provided the leadership, he had the grit to get through that campaign. And that really always stuck with me. And it followed on, you know, reforming the tax system, the manufacturing tax at 13.5%, with just one segment of the industry to kind of, you know, reform taxes, bring them down and make it fairer, the privatized assets to get government out of the way and into the right areas. It took a lot of vision. It took some leadership and some grit. And long-term thinking. And I think what I love most about our budget and our plan is that it's, I'm too humble to say that it's anywhere near what Mulroney and his team did, but it's building the infrastructure, it's building the economy, it's supporting the workers, and it doesn't deviate from that plan.
Okay. So what are, if you could nail down, what are its key objectives? What are the things that you want this budget to try to address?
Yeah, I think two things: rebuild the economy and focus on affordability. You know, we have to rebuild the economy. Like just a few days ago, Statistics Canada came out with their 2024 numbers. Ontario's population grew by 533,000 people last year. You know, in the last 2 years, it's 1 million people. So when the Nick Bethenfeld, who's an Esther Bethenfeld, who's Esther Kostofi, my mother, you know, when they came to this country, you know, we gave them a Molson Export and said, good luck to you. In fact, we gave them $5. But we made sure that there was the housing, I mean, that the jobs were there, that the infrastructure, the schools, that you could set, you could raise your family. And I think that's number one. As we come out of a pandemic, as we come out of these interest rates, inflation that we haven't seen in a long time, we have to continue rebuilding not only the economy, good jobs, you know, the bigger paychecks, you know, the opportunities, but also the schools, the hospitals, the roads, the highways, the public transit, the broadband, the long-term care facilities. So I think this budget, first and foremost, is about a continuation of that plan to rebuild the economy. I think number two, though, as I think it was Harold Macmillan said, what's the
events
thing? What's the biggest challenge in government? Events, dear boy. Events, dear David. Events.
Yeah.
And, you know, so many people are hurting today. You know, you asked me at the beginning, how do I like talking to everybody on Main Street and around the province? I got to tell you, this is they feel like we're in a deep recession. They're not sure where the money's going to come for next week's groceries, or how they're going to make the rent payment, or how they're going to afford the rollover on their mortgages, or, you know, filling up the gas tank. You know, that's a real thing. And so our budget is also very much focused on helping people through this challenging time.
I promised you a different, pithy, four-word metaphor this week, Hurly Burlyites, and here it is: skin in the game. Heck, all of us have probably used that phrase or felt the responsibility embedded within it. It's when you have an investment or a personal stake in a thing, leading to an outsized interest in its success. Our presenting sponsor, TELUS, has always believed it's been the key to providing Canadians with the highest quality in our internet networks. They've lived that belief, making generational investments to connect us for decades. In February, TELUS made a compelling presentation at CRTC hearings looking into options for mandating wholesale wireline fiber to the premises. The question? How to do it in a way that best promotes competition, giving us choice and affordability. Two models are under consideration. One, aggregated access, which allows wholesale resellers to simply lease space on an existing fiber network, ride those lines without investing in any network components or connection points to a town or region. And two, disaggregated access, which requires resellers to invest in and maintain a portion of the network, to have a little skin in the game by building new and more connection points to the communities they serve. The result is a tangible commitment to their customers through investment in new facilities, and improved flexibility, reliability, and resiliency in the network by building those connection points, which reduces single points of failure. Oh, and it's also consistent with the CRTC's own recent MVNO framework that requires upfront investment to tie mobile network resellers to a community and its customers. Skin in the game, proven time and time again to do wonders for commitment, responsibility, and successful outcomes, Hurley Burleyites. In this case, driving the most sustainable form of competition while keeping our network quality at a world-leading level. Well, let's talk about the economy off the top before we get to some of the other issues around services, etc. I mean, the thing that everybody in intellectual circles is obsessing about in Canada right now is productivity. And our productivity appears to have ground to a dead halt. Very little productivity growth forecast for as long as the eye can see by international organizations in Canada. It's not a purely Canadian problem. It's a bit of a world problem, but we are among the worst performers by most accounts. And productivity translates very directly into standard of living, right? So if we're going to get people to have bigger, better jobs with better wages, that's going to come from a more productive economy. I haven't, on this show, found a lot of people who have a lot of answers to how to get productivity growing again in Canada. What are you doing in this budget about that?
We're doing lots of things, but let me start off by saying, you know, our whole plan is about economic prosperity. Just insert productivity and prosperity. They go together hand in hand. I do think the private sector has to do a lot more on productivity. And what do I mean by that? They got to invest, not just let government have the solution to everything. In fact, if we rely on government to come up with solutions for everything, it's toast. We got to work hand in hand. The private sector's got to invest more in the tools necessary to give workers, whether it's software or different types of technology or investments in education, retraining, et cetera. Private sector, R&D, research and development, you know, lean in, Canadian businesses, be bold. You know, don't wait for government to get going and then I'll get going. Be bold, open up competition, innovate, invest more in the future, invest in your workers. So I'll say, get that out first. You know, what is this government doing since we got elected? And a big reason I'm in government is just that. I'll call it economic prosperity. And how do I think about that? And what is the government doing? Well, I'll talk first about infrastructure. You know, our modeling shows that in 10 years, the 400 series, you will be in 100% gridlock. How is that productive if people can't take their kids to school or get goods to market? You got to build in. How can you accept 1 million people and not invest in productive assets and infrastructure? By that, we mean building those highways, building 4 subway lines at the same time, extending the GO light rail transit system around Ontario, building hospitals, building schools, building long-term care facilities, investing in broadband. All of these things count as infrastructure. In our budget, $190 billion, 10-year plan, the most and the biggest in the history of Canada for Ontario. So number one, these are long-term assets. By the way, these deficits will pass. We got a slower economy, but I've been around a long time. Economies slow and then they pick up. But these investments in long-term assets will go on for a long, they'll be around for generations. They'll be around. The first subways were built in 1910, I think, or something like that. They're still around over 100 years later. So you have to have a vision. The second thing I would say that we're leaning into is you got to give workers the tools. You know, the people who are building that infrastructure, you know, you got to retrain, you got to give technology. So the Skills Development Fund, which has been a core part of my 4 budgets now, has retrained and reskilled over 400,000 people. And I'll pause there for a second because it's not ideology here. We have an aging population, a number of millwrights and carpenters and, you know, you name it, electricians and crane operators that are about to retire, healthcare workers.
Pollsters,
podcasters, except for podcasters. They're going to keep going. You know, like you got to invest in that because you got to train for the jobs of tomorrow and give them the skills and the tools. And not only those to build those things, the construction workers. We're building nuclear, small modular reactors, right? We're building everything. But you got to also have the service economy, the healthcare workers, the educators, the people that are going to do the home care, the personal support workers. So we're leaning in so that our workers can be more productive. It doesn't mean making working more hours. It means being more effective in the time that you have. And thirdly, you know, it's kind of like, the vampires, you know, you try to kill red tape. It's not easy. I remember when I got elected. So regulations, red tape. I remember when I got elected, two things I noticed on my I got a landline and the fax machines were everywhere. And I said, we got to get rid of these landlines. It's 2018. Let's go. So they're gone. They're done. They're gone. You won't find a line in anywhere in government. But fax machines are like the vampires. I can't seem to kill the fax machine. I came up with a slogan, axe the fax. And now I know where Pierre Poilievre
got. I was going to say.
I want a commission because but the hard thing is, and much like we're trying to axe the tax and we're fighting shoulder to shoulder with Pierre Poilievre and his team, you know, the fax machine, we got to get rid of that. We've got to use technology, you know, so that's, to me, economic prosperity. I would take out productivity and call it economic prosperity. And if you have economic prosperity, you can afford and invest in everything that goes to support the social economy, is my view.
Do you have any ideas about what could change business behavior? What could unlock the investments you're talking about? I mean, Canadian businesses seem to invest in innovation much less than American companies do, and it's having an impact.
Well, I think competition is definitely one area. When you have to compete, you're going to innovate to attract customers, to retain customers. So we got to lean in. If you look in my budget, the number of innovation funds that we have, the Critical Minerals Innovation Fund, innovation is through it. The Advanced Manufacturing Innovation and Competition Stream. You know, we have to lean in and open up competition and really pressure businesses to innovate. And there's gold at the end because it'll mean that you'll have customer retention, you'll have new customers. So, and we just have to be bolder in Canada. I'll put our Canadian businesses and workers up against any in the world. You know, so we just have to have the right mindset. We have to have governments that support that. And I think one thing you can say, I hope you would agree, that Doug Ford and our team is very much focused on innovation and competition and the things that unleash that in making the economy more prosperous. Not sure I see always the things out of Ottawa. In fact, I'm very sure we don't see that often out of Ottawa. And that economic prosperity agenda is not easy. It's hard work. But let's work with the private sector. Let's work with workers and government to kind of on that innovation agenda. And it can be done.
Okay. Is there enough risk capital in Ontario to generate that kind of innovation?
Yeah, there is. You know, when I first took the job, there was a task force led by a capital markets task force led by Waleed Solomon on how to reform the capital markets in Ontario. 74 recommendations. I think we're more than halfway through all those recommendations. I just came from a meeting with the Ontario Securities Commission. They have a 6-year strategic plan. Innovations all over the place. Capital formation. I changed the objects of the OSC to include. Add two things, capital formation and competition. Two of the things we just, you know, talked about competition, you just talked about capital formation. I'll put up our Canadian businesses and workers up against anybody. I give you, though, an example of how we often get in our own way. So we're investing heavily on advanced manufacturing and the electric vehicle transition that's happening, which is good for the clean economy, the green economy. They're great jobs. Their bigger paychecks. And important in that is not only attracting the capital domestic and abroad to invest in electric vehicles, but also the critical minerals up in the north. And it's like pulling your hind teeth to get everyone aligned to allow for more effective permitting, to allow for infrastructure to be built. There's so many roadblocks, and yet the world is screaming for those critical minerals. China's got most of them, and I don't know. I'd rather go with Northern Ontario than China. And I know someone else who is, the President of the United States. So I think that we really have to, you know, we can be competitive. I'll put up our ability to mine ethically responsibly, reliably, environmentally sensitive up against any jurisdiction on the planet. We'll do it the best. And we have the people, we have the technology. By the way, the First Nations are leading the Ring of Fire in terms of a reference for the environmental assessment up there. They're partners, they're leading it. You can't do it alone. So I think we can compete. I think we've got the capital. I think we've got the talent. We just have to be bold. And again, going back to Mulroney, these are big ideas. There's a lot of inertia against getting things done in this province, in this country. And I would just say, learn from him, learn from others, have the grit and the courage to just keep going.
Okay. A little slight switch of topics here. The bane of every provincial finance minister's existence is healthcare spending. It takes up half of your budget and growing, and all people do is shit on you about it. So it's not a very rewarding way to spend money, but nonetheless, you did spend some money on it in this budget. But to be honest, from the outside, it looks like the whole healthcare system is being held together with duct tape and binder twine, and that what's in this budget is too incremental to really shift that direction. Am I wrong?
Wrong. Who's that guy? Right. McLaughlin hours.
Yeah.
Wrong.
Yeah.
Let's first off say that I've come across so many nurses and personal support workers and family physicians and specialists. And I got to tell you, and I lived in the States for a while. I've been in Europe. We've got a great healthcare system. So let's start there. Do we need to transform it with an aging population, a growing population? Absolutely. And in fact, in the OECD, we spend more money. We're at the top quartile on spending money per capita on healthcare, but our outcomes are not in the first quartile. So as you rightfully point out, my budget the last 2 years has increased $10 billion. It's about around 6% a year. So it's not a failure of funds. But what it is we have to transform that healthcare system. And this budget is another piece in that transformation. And let me explain what that means. You know, for too long, we've got a healthcare system that's just in time based on a physical hospital model. You know, even in flu season, we used to have emergency department overflow and hallway medicine, et cetera. We get a pandemic, and boy, does that expose that model. So we have to transform to make sure care is in the proper place. And what do I mean by that? Let's start with home care. You know, more people want to age at home than they do in an institution of a hospital, even though they get great care, but they could have the care at home. I put $2 billion in this budget to advance the amount of home care, to hire more personal support workers and nurses and healthcare workers in the home. But it also means things like primary care. We put another $500 million to be able to have 600,000 more patients have a family doctor on top of the 300,000 we announced 3 months ago.
Yeah, so but I'm not being critical, but it still leaves a million people without a family, without a primary physician. So I'm not saying you should have solved that in this budget, but it's hard to see how we get there. It's such a big number.
No. Here's a roadmap. You know, and you're right. You don't inherit that system. And by the way, the previous government did not build the hospitals. In fact, there were fewer nurses. I think there were 1,600 nurses laid off in the period. They were, they just didn't have the same vision. We're going the complete opposite, but you don't turn on a dime. David, what I'm saying is that we have a plan on how to transform from acute care. We've investing in building more hospitals and acute beds because there weren't enough beds. We're investing in family physicians. In fact, my budget announced in York University, the first ever medical school in Canada targeted for family physicians. We did that with Queen's University and Lake Ridge Health in Durham. Jane Philpott was terrific advising me on how to do that. But that takes time. So there's some short-term things that will get done. We're not going to move it overnight, but I want to be very clear. We have a plan. More home care, more mental health and acute care, more mental health and addiction care, more acute care, more hospital beds, supporting hiring. I put in $750 million more for more nurses and more digital into the system. So there's not just one magic bullet, but our goal is, and I've talked to the Ontario Health Hospitals Association, the OMA Medical Association, you got to innovate with us. Because it's a growing population, it's an aging population, but if you do it the same old way and expect a different outcome, you know what the definition of that is.
Yeah. I'm actually super interested in your home care offensive. You put a pretty big number beside it in the budget. And I'm wondering, you talk about vision. I'm wondering what the vision you're building toward is in terms of home care and long-term care and for-profit long-term care. And you're obviously intending to shift the mix of those things. And I think that's positive. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, thanks for expanding on that. Traditional is you'd get sick and go into a hospital, or if you couldn't be taken care of, go in a long-term care home. But that's not the only place that people want to age and need their treatment. So, but how do you do that? First of all, there's a complete complexity around the administration and delivery of that, hence the creation of Ontario Health. That was the first piece of being able to transform this. So they're the ones that are coordinating that care, bringing the home care in, and being able to allocate the resources. Number two, you have to have the resources. So you have to have the supply of personal support workers, the nurse practitioners, registered nurses, registered practical nurses, and a big part of the budget is make sure not only can we attract them for home care, but we can pay them. Because, they've got to be paid fairly to be able to do that work, and it's working. And I've seen it in action, and the rewards, the patient experience being treated at home versus a hospital is through the roof. And by the way, how do we pay for it? The cost of taking care of someone at home is much lower than the cost of having that person in a hospital bed. So you're actually taking existing investments and shifting where those priorities are. So I think it is a recognition that we have to invest in healthcare in a different way than we've invested in the past.
Right. And are you still going to be building long-term care beds? Do people want those things, really?
Yes, because too often the families take care of their loved ones that they're either incapacitated or have dementia or Alzheimer's. There isn't really the ability 24/7, and really a long-term care place is the last place that the last place that can provide that kind of service 24/7. There are no other options. But
can they be better?
Yes,
Can they be better places?
They are better. I'll tell you an example. So in my riding in Pickering, from 2011 to 2018, 7 years, people are aging, wait lists are getting longer. You know how many new beds were built? Squadouche. That's a technical finance term for zero that I learned in New York. Squadouche. So what we're doing is we are fast-tracking building these modern beds, and we put one called the Ajax, right beside the Ajax Pickering Hospital. It's called Lake Ridge Gardens. We built that thing in 13 months, 320 beds, right beside the hospital. So now you're getting care that's, right in place. It's modern. It's also got a dialysis treatment center in the long-term care facility. You can do diagnostics. There's a new way of thinking about how to provide that long-term care financially responsibly, meeting patient demand and desire where they can no longer be taken care of at home. You know, Lisa Raitt talks about her husband. She tried to, sadly had his deterioration and she couldn't have, she had to move him to a facility. Sometimes you have no other option. So yes, we have to build them. They can be built really effective to modern standards, and we got to keep building them because, David, you and I are still aging.
Absolutely. I can feel it. And can those be real jobs that people can live and raise a family on? One of the things we learned in the pandemic is that most of the people doing these jobs are scrambling and having to do it in multiple different places and maybe have a second job and somewhere else. And this was a big problem in the spread of COVID in these homes. But it also makes you feel, shouldn't these people be paid a reasonable wage?
Well, and that's why I talked about the $2 billion for home care. And that's a big chunk of where that's going. It's going for wages. We increased the PSW pay, the personal support workers, through the pandemic. One time, $4 an hour, which is a big, on a relative basis, was a big increase. Then after the pandemic, we increased it permanently by $3 an hour. And these are good jobs. And we've increased the standard of care. So you get 4 hours. Now it's the highest level in Canada, to my knowledge, which means you have to have, on average, 4 hours of care in each long-term care facility, which is really the gold standard in Canada. So I've met a lot of these people. They're coming through the colleges. They're coming, you know, from around the world. These people are amazing people, and they're very rewarding jobs.
So there was a longish piece in the Hill Times the other day about the country's supply chains. For those of you who have been underground spelunking for the past 4 years, supply chains are the end-to-end links joining growers, miners, manufacturers, shippers, wholesalers, retailers, warehousers, and transporters to customers. Supply chains keep shelves stocked and life running normally. During the pandemic, they were a bit of a disaster. Russia's invasion of Ukraine made things worse. It seemed like the system's lug nuts were stripping and gaskets were blowing everywhere. Anyway, our supply chains are working better now. You may have noticed new cars are back in showrooms, stuff you order online is arriving more punctually, building materials are returning to normal price levels. The federal government has actually pitched in, creating a national supply chain office to help coordinate all the different players involved in delivering goods to Canadians. But as the CEO of Supply Chain Canada pointed out in the Hill Times piece, problems remain. Canada lags in areas like automation, and all players on the supply chain must collaborate more than they do. Our sponsor, CN, is one of those players. Were it not for its punctual performance, our supply chains would collapse. CN believes transparent data sharing is key. It already shares more data with the public than any other railway and has repeatedly urged other supply chain participants to follow suit. This is serious stuff, people. We need to ensure the breakdowns and disruptions of recent years don't recur. The new government office should require full cooperation from every link in the chain. It's a matter of the common good. Housing. Can't get through this interview without talking about housing. It's the issue du jour. Both levels of government are getting hammered on it. You have measures in your budget to deal with it, but I haven't read anybody who thinks that Ontario will meet its home building targets. Are you optimistic about affordable home ownership in the future, in the near future?
Absolutely. I'm very optimistic, and I'll tell you why. I talked to you at the beginning about Mulroney and his grit and his leadership. You know, nothing goes up in a straight line to 1.5 million homes. You get hit with a pandemic. You get hit with high interest rates and inflation that you haven't seen in a long time. You hit different municipalities going one way, federal government going another way. You know what? We're going to barrel through all that, and we're going to get the job done. And I am optimistic because when we think about housing, it's just not affordable housing. I think about it, it's student housing. We just talked about seniors housing, you know, in institutions, but also different types of seniors-friendly living. We talk about supportive housing, which I put a lot of money into supportive housing as the finance minister. It's about, you know, building up in density. It's about building around transit. It's about building where we can, front door, back door. So it's all of the above. And it's the issue of our time. We can't have a generation, the MZ, I guess they're calling it now, MZ or MZ, millennials plus Z, you know, 18 to 40, who the dream of home ownership is just gone. That's like in my lifetime, the next generation always had the hope of ownership, and we've put it out of reach.
To be honest, an expectation.
Sorry?
To be honest, it was an expectation.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
People of our generation wouldn't have occurred to us that we would not be able to buy a house at some point in our life.
Right. And you know, I think that whatever type of housing, whether you come from abroad or you're born here, I mean, everyone's from somewhere else other than Indigenous, you know, it's our job to make sure when we're in government that the next generation has the opportunities we had. We give it them a little bit better than what we found it. And on the housing side, we've got to do a lot more.
Given how rents have skyrocketed, do you regret dropping rent control?
No, and to be clear, rent controls exist from 2018 and previously built, so they're still in place. I think we're at 2.5% cap. But we have to incent new buildings, and so the rent controls don't exist on new buildings. And there's some, you know, if you redevelop a unit or renovate, there's other things that allow you to increase rent. But here's how I think of it. We have to put incentives in place for people to want to build these things. And I'll tell you a good example of what I put in my budget a year ago. I said, hey, Chrystia Freeland, if I'm prepared to waive the HST for purpose-built rental, You administer our tax system, so I need you to do it. So my 8% and your 5% takes 13% off, and to their credit, in September of this year, last year, they did it. That's really helping and sent a lot of purpose-built rentals. I did something else in the budget this time. I said, municipalities, if you want to lower your property tax rates for purpose-built rental, here's the blanket approval for you to do it up to 35%. Finding ways to incent more rental stock, you know, because it's great to put rent controls in, and then if the supply stays static and the demand goes through the roof, you know, you're going to have a crisis.
So that's what rent controls do, is they deter investment.
Well, we've seen that we've seen very little investment. In fact, our starts on rental stock in the last 2 years have been the highest. I think the last time they were this high, the Habs had won a cup in 86.
I was there.
In 93. See, yep. I had to get that in.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, so that's how far back you have to get. That only now is the stock increasing from those, you know, like in terms of the annual starts.
Geez, you've really distracted me now. You know, this Slavkovsky's going to be a player, eh?
What's that, sorry?
This Slavkovsky's going to be a player.
Hope breeds eternal.
So, the headline number on your budget was the deficit number. It's the headline budget on many budgets, and it was on yours. How do you feel about that deficit number?
You know, I go back to, I'm going to quote Harold Macmillan, his family will want royalties. Events, dear David, events. The high interest rates, the inflation, the global economy softening. But, you know, put our deficit in context. You know, Quebec printed almost $11 billion. Their economy is half the size of ours. Ours is twice the size. We're over $1.1 trillion, and ours is $9.8 billion, so smaller than Quebec's. We're not immune from the global slowdown, the economic slowdown. So the largest reason for our deficit over our plan is a revenue drop. But I'll tell you this, we are of similar size provinces, and we'll see what Ottawa does, the only province to have a path to balance. And I'll tell you this as well, deficits will pass, and I'm committed. I'm a fiscal conservative to the core. But I believe that you can be fiscally responsible and make these investments. They have to be targeted investments, so infrastructure, workers, economy. You can do both. But these deficits will pass. And these assets that we're building, hospitals, the long-term care that we talked about, the highways, the transit lines in Toronto, right across the province, the broadband we're investing in, those will be around for generations and generations.
So you just lied to me because you called yourself a fiscal conservative, I would always have thought that you were. Having known you, I would always have thought that you were, but I'm now reliably informed by people like Sean Spear and Randall Denley that you are not. I'm being a little flip, but some of the most trenchant criticism of the budget is coming from conservative circles, who say it's not a conservative budget, and if it was, you would have cut spending rather than run that deficit.
You know, I don't think I would respectfully, I know them all, have respect for them, and I'm going to completely disagree with them. I think that this is a fiscally responsible budget, as all of my budgets have been tracking towards a path to balance, keeping interest costs. They didn't point out that my interest costs are 6.8 cents on the dollar, which is the lowest in Ontario in 40 years. In fact, if you look at my budget, it goes back almost 40 years on the interest expense to revenue. And David, you would know better than most that interest costs can eat up a lot of your program spending. And I remember a government 30 cents on the dollar, every taxpayer dollar.
33
to bondholders, 67 yeah. left over. Mm. I'm at 6.8, the lowest in 40 years. So I have more money on program spending. By how am I doing? The deficits have been declining. I have a path to balance. Why the debt is, I'm issuing some debt, is for infrastructure. And I can issue, we just issued 30-year bonds yesterday. We're getting great rates. Ontario's credit spreads are the tightest. In fact, we're borrowing the cheapest of any province in Canada. And we haven't been able to say that for two decades in or a long time in Ontario. So we're getting the benefit of being fiscally responsible. Our interest costs are lower. We're committed to a path to balance. But I would say events, dear Sean, events, and these deficits and these economies will pass, and we'll be in much better shape because we didn't slow down those critical investments. In fact, to slow those down would be the height of non-fiscal conservatism.
Okay. Is there any room to raise revenue through taxation, or are we capped at what we can do there? Is there still room to deal with the fiscal situation a bit through taxation?
No, I don't think we need to. I think we've got a proven plan to fix the economy, to invest in the infrastructure, to keep our borrowing costs really low, and let the economy and the ingenuity and the innovation of the economy grow. Like when we took over, and you were there back in 2018, the economy was $150 billion of revenue for our taxpayers. We've cut taxes and cut fees and cut tolls, and our revenues have gone up $55 billion. Yes, our expenditures have gone up, but we've been able to reduce the percentage of expenditures prudently by being very targeted. So I just happen to believe that economic prosperity is critically important. Give people the opportunity to earn good paychecks. And that's how we'll afford the world-class healthcare and education and social services that we have.
I've heard a rumor the federal budget's going to include a wealth tax. What do you think about that?
Not much. Not much. I don't think that's the path. I don't know. Taxing your way to prosperity has never, I don't know how that works. And, you know, and we've cut taxes. In fact, my budget outlines that through reducing fees, tolls, and taxes, last year we saved the average Ontarian $8.4 billion. I just happen to believe putting money in people's pockets, particularly in this tough time, the Premier echoes that time and time again, creates long-term prosperity. Taking money out of people's pockets, is not the right solution. So, you know, I think my first go-to is cut taxes. My second go-to is cut fees. And my third is pause any. Don't, and then keep them the same. Don't increase them for anybody.
All right. Now, I'm going to give you a chance to address the left-wingers on social media who are having a heyday with the fact that you're spending $10 billion more than Kathleen Wynne did in her last budget. What is that money going to? Is it interest rates? Is it inflation? Or are you more activist than that government was? Or how have you ended up outspending them?
Well, context again. It was a lower interest rate environment, lower expense base. There's something called the pandemic that happened through that, where we had to expand our balance sheet and our expenditures. Inflation has repriced everything, and we've gone through that. You know, we've incorporated all that in our budget, and we have a path to balance. And I think, you know, any finance minister, the biggest job, because as you know, you've got to ration scarce dollars. And where are you going to put those dollars? And we've been very clear. We ran on my budget in 2022. We're investing in the economy. We're investing in infrastructure. We're investing in workers. We're going to fortify our healthcare system, and we're going to keep costs down. That hasn't changed. If you look at my first budget, second budget, third budget, fourth budget, and I'm looking at it, Building a Better Ontario is the last one. It's the same one all the way through. And tell the people over and over again, you know, what that plan is and how you spent their money. I'm out every 90 days as the finance minister. I'm like a CEO that says, you know, here's how I spent your money. Here's how things are going. And I'm taking the tough questions from media and institutions on how I'm doing. And I don't think there's been a finance minister in a long time that's gone out every 90 days. And, you know, David, going out in front of the press and facing the public is not the easiest thing to do, but it builds credibility, it builds transparency and confidence that we're on the right path.
Okay. The last issue I want to run with you before I let you go after all this is clean energy, climate, and the role that all plays. And I'll just be honest that I'm a little confused about your government's posture on this. So initially anti-renewables, but latterly more supportive of renewables again, opposed both the cap and trade system and the currently opposed the carbon tax. So I can assume the government's against carbon pricing, but nonetheless seems to be investing a lot of hope for Ontario's future economic growth on a clean energy environment, on these changes that will occur. So whether it's the investments in battery plants that you and the federal government have made together, or whether it's the focus on getting critical minerals out, the policy seems to be founded on an end result that the government is in a way fighting. Can you bring some coherence to all that for me?
Oh, I'd love to. So first off, I got to get it out there. I think the carbon tax is not having on consumers is not having the intended impact of changing behavior and lowering emissions. So we cut the gas tax. We're providing relief at a time when, you know, on many inputs require that kind of relief. We do have a plan though on a green economy. And I'll put up our green economy plan against anybody's, including Justin Trudeau's. It's an investment in a clean electricity grid. And that's why we're quadrupling down on nuclear, which, by the way, in my riding of Pickering, is very supported by the majority to refurbish the Pickering nuclear station. Just down the road, the 401, we're putting in the first small modular reactor.
Refurbishing it is certainly more reassuring than just letting it run past its due date, which was a little...
But, you know, we've refurbished parts of Bruce Power and Darlington. We have the skill set and the engineers and done safely security. And these are good jobs and it's green, clean.
And relatively on budget. Recently, I mean, nuclear used to be crazy out of off budget, but now they've kind of solved those problems, haven't they?
Great point. You know, Ontario Power Generation, they're delivering these overhauls on time or ahead of schedule and on budget or below budget because the know-how is really there. And by the way, we have a lot of skilled trades and engineers and power workers working on these. And they, like, the world is now saying, what the heck? Ontario's way ahead of the curve because this will power our clean energy grid for a long time. Look, I was just in Germany not too long ago. They had to give up gas because of the supply from Russia. They had to fire up those coal plants. You know, they're around 30%.
Only because they shut down their nukes, those bastards.
Yeah, well, you know, they didn't have the foresight. And now the world is starting to say, you know, I think nuclear is actually a way to go. So you're seeing that global conversation change. I've heard people say, and I agree, there's no path to net zero without nuclear. And so we're on that path. And we're doing it, you know, we have about 10% that we've got to use gas in the interim till we get all this built, plus renewables and the hydro. But Volkswagen, in part, comes to here because we have one of the cleanest, greenest electricity grids in the world, right here in Ontario. So we're on the right track. We're also working with the private sector to get coal out of the steel manufacturing process. And, man, you should go up to Sault Ste. Marie and see what the heck's happening there, converting to electricity on their coal. On their steel making, that's gonna allow them to produce more, to modulate their production, to reduce emissions and be more competitive, which means bigger margins and more employment stability and bigger paychecks. They're doing it in Hamilton as well with DFASCO. Our EV investments, which I'm, you know, advanced manufacturing, we got the talent base, the know-how, the critical minerals from the Ring of Fire right through to the battery assembly manufacturing and the car assembly. And so I've issued more, and we as a government have issued more green bonds than all the provinces and the federal government combined. We just issued another $1.5 billion. These are to fund sustainable projects, including nuclear. We just changed to include nuclear. And the world is, you know, really looking at what the heck is going on in Ontario. They are becoming as conservative on the environment as Mike Harris and Brian Mulroney. Had to get that in.
Well, I mean, I want to ask you because, like, some people who oppose the carbon tax really oppose the whole agenda. And they think that all this electric vehicle stuff is bullshit and this change is never going to happen and we're going to still burn fossil fuels. But that's not your opinion. You believe this change is happening. You believe people are going to drive electric cars. You believe that we are going to make steel in a different way, etc.
Yeah, I really do, and I think that we're gonna be leaders in the world on that. And I think we're very short sighted, not thinking about our gas production, for example, in Canada, which is a comparative advantage to replace coal in the rest of the world. We'll have a better impact on global emissions. That if we help economies who are so reliant on coal still, Japan, that industrial, you know, machine is still 22% of electricity grid is coal. you go south of the border, there's still a big chunk of coal. So why don't we do, the Germans would give their left arms for our gas because 50% cleaner than oil. Is it zero carbon emission? No. But as we transition, Canada is so well placed to make that transition to help the world get off of coal and get off of different fossil fuels and transition to the green economy. So I think what we're showing in Ontario, David, is a different path to net zero. I think we're on the right track. I just don't believe that on the backs of consumers is the way to get the net zero.
Okay. I want to close with one question for you, which is, if it's one thing I learned from Paul Martin, it's that the thinking and planning for the next budget starts the day after the last budget. So what are you going to be thinking about over the next year? What are your priorities going to be in terms of, I know that you've got a plan that you're working on, so I'm not expecting you to tell me I've got a new plan that's going to do a bunch of different things, but what are you thinking about as the next phase of this?
Yeah, great question. Great observation. We had a strategy session on Tuesday, which I think was yesterday. You lose track of time in business, to do exactly that. We mapped out fall economic statement, the budget for next year, and the fall economic statement for 2025, because we're in the long-term planning business. And where we can really continue to build on those core things, you're never perfect in government, far from it, as you know. Events, dear David, events. But, you know, you got to stick, you have to have a North Star. And our plan for Ontario, where building these highways, building these hospitals, we're in gridlock. If you think we're in gridlock today, so we think about, if you don't build those highways, if you don't get shovels in the ground, if you don't get dirt and flying, if you don't train the workers to be able to operate the elevators, the cranes, build the nuclear facilities, what more can you do? And I spend a lot of time talking to people. I've been out ever since the budget, talking to people, talking to businesses, meeting with associations. Give me your best ideas. And you would know that if you've got a vision and a plan and you stick to it, and you're transparent about it, not everyone's going to agree with you. Not everyone votes for me as much as I'd like them to, or our government. But at least we're telling them what we stand for and how we're going to do it. So I think very insightful. I just want to continue doing, you don't just say, okay, these are the highways you have to build. These are the hospitals. These are the long-term care. You got to say, okay, now what's the next wave? And how can you, train the workers? How can you attract more people to Canada? How can you make sure they're in the right area? They're welders and they're electricians and carpenters and all that stuff, healthcare workers. So that's what you work on.
Great. Well, good luck to you, Minister.
Well, thank you, Dave.
And it's in all of our interest that you be a great success. So be a great success.
It was great fun to be with you. And all I can say is keep doing the great work you're doing. You're bringing some great minds together. And I love your show and listening to it. So keep up the great work.
Well, thank you very much. And thank you for giving us your time today. All right, Hurley Burleyites, that's the Hurley Burley for this week with Minister Peter Bethlen-Falvey. We can't hit this standard every week, but we'll try to give you a good show next week again if you tune back in. In the meantime, take care of yourselves. I'd like to thank our presenting sponsor, TELUS, and our sponsor, CN Rail. Hurley Burley. Hurley Burley. Hurley Burley. Hurley Burley.